Hey everyone, this is Cameron from Renegade Animation on renegadepopculture.com. If you like what we do, please give us a like, a follow, and a rating on Apple Podcasts and anywhere you listen to them. We are everywhere. That way, we can keep doing what we love, and that's Rock the Dragon and talking about Dragon Balls. And now, on with the show.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Renegade Animation on the Renegade Pop Culture Podcast Network. My name is Mike. I'll be your host for this evening. Joining me, as always, is the animation guru himself, Cameron.
Howdy, howdy.
And yeah, today is a mini episode for a movie that has been one of my most anticipated all year. We are talking about Dragon Ball Super, Super Hero. Now, before we get into the movie itself, Dragon Ball has been a franchise that has been a pretty big part of my life. I've been a fan at least going as far back as like the early 2000s. In fact, it was actually my brother who introduced me to the show because he started watching around the time that the Frieza saga was airing on Toonami. And then just from there, I just sort of picked up interest where he left off. And that's pretty much where my love for this franchise begins. But Cameron, how did you get into Dragon Ball?
Way when it was like starting to air in America, pretty much like when like ocean dubs were the default version of Dragon Ball Z you watched. This was like, before Funimation really took over and such.
Back when like it was on Kids WB for like a month.
Oh, it was on some channel, I forgot which one. And then it got moved to Toonami with Gundam and Batman and such. Very super influential action TV for young kids back then. And just in general with anime, because it's still one of the most popular franchises out there.
It has to be at least like in the top five, if not number one.
I would argue it's in the top 10 at least,
Fair.
because it's hard to beat one Dragon Quest to One Piece. And then, of course, we have like the fluctuating popularity of stuff like Naruto, Demon Slayer, My Hero, Jujutsu Kaisen, and Lupin the Third, and what have you. Then, of course, I loved the show whenever I could catch it. And then it got more exciting when they're like, okay, we're finally bringing over more episodes, because it seems like they started with the Saiyan Saga and then stopped right when the Ginyu Force during the either Namek or Frieza Saga was about to rev up. One of them was about to end, and then the other part of the arc was about to begin. I watched, of course, throughout its own run, and when, through the Cell Saga, the Buu Saga, and the controversial Dragon Ball GT adaptation. And then I fell out of it because it became harder to find and watch just because of the shift in what was being broadcasted on TV. And then it took up like a late night slot on Adult Swim, if I remember correctly, for a while.
Yep.
And then, yeah, for some reason, like Nickelodeon got the rights to air it at one point, and then it went back to Funimation, and then got back onto like action television programming blocks, and then Adult Swim would have like the uncut episodes and such. And that was when they were also starting to bring over the original Dragon Ball. They would have them like kind of airing side by side at one point.
I remember that back in the early 2000s when after Dragon Ball Z had already become sort of a global sensation, then Cartoon Network was like, oh, you know what? We also have Dragon Balls. Let's go ahead and air that. And then Funimation started releasing like the home video of the actual uncut episodes. And wow, the differences between the edited versions of Dragon Ball and the uncut episodes were, I don't want to say they were night and day, but you could definitely tell that they were edited for television.
Well, I don't blame them. Dragon Ball was meant to be like, oh, we're going to aim for the kids. And then it's like, How are we going to work around some of this stuff? Like, of course, they couldn't say death. They had to say, like, I'm going to send you to the next dimension. Or the infamous Ocean's dub like lines of like, look, I can see their parachutes. They're okay. Or when they blew up a vehicle that had people in it. Oh no, it was a supply vehicle. And it's like,
sure.
Yeah, no, it was wild when you watch the uncut episodes and then some of the stuff that was actually left out. Presumably because this was before Dragon Ball aired. So like they would have characters pop up from time to time and people would be like, who are these characters and such? Because Dragon Ball is like decades long and such. And it's always amusing when you go back to the original Dragon Ball opening with that cool, rockin', iconic guitar shred.
Mm-hmm.
How they would only use footage from the movies back then.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that until rewatching it recently. And I was like, wow, this is like a ton of false advertising. Not that to say it's not action packed. Like, it was one of those early franchise anime where the common joke was, we're going to stand around for 5 episodes, but in the time frame of the show, it's only going to be like 5 minutes. It's a lot.
Like, it is a lot, but I honestly owe this franchise a great debt of gratitude for introducing a lot of the media that I love, from the music I listen to obviously the landscape of anime as a whole. Pretty much every aspect of pop culture can be traced back to some capacity to Dragon Ball.
Right, right. No, it's super influential. Like, even people who are not into anime know at least the name Dragon Ball. And then after a while, it just kind of stopped. Everyone was like, okay, we are moving on to Naruto. And then One Piece was getting a second chance in life. Then, of course, the infamous live action movie that came out that went through so much studio notes, so many studio notes, and was so bad that Akira Toriyama was like, no, I'm coming back. I'm going to fix this nonsense.
And even around that time is when we got Team Four Stars, Dragon Ball Z Abridged. Of course, video games have been circulating throughout like the past 20 years.
Right, right. A lot of things could be contributing to how and why the franchise has stayed as long as it has. Then, of course, Dragon Ball Super came out. A lot of mixed reviews, a lot of, I don't know what to think about it, reactions. And, of course, there are the two specials that came out, the Battle of the Gods and then that one, The Return of Frieza.
Oh, yeah, Resurrection F. That was a thing that existed. Battle of Gods, though, is awesome. And absolutely the shot in the arm that the franchise needed.
Right, right. And then, like, at the pinnacle of, like, its revival era, Dragon Ball Super Broly came out, made a stupid amount of money, got a lot of attention for better or for worse. Then we waited 3.5 years, and then a new Dragon Ball film finally came out.
And that's where we're at right now. This is actually the directorial debut for Tetsuro Kodama from a screenplay written by Toriyama himself. And basically the plot of this movie is we have the return of the Red Ribbon Army, an evil organization that was once destroyed by Son Goku. Individuals who carry on its spirit have created the ultimate androids, Gamma 1 and Gamma 2. However, these two androids call themselves superheroes and start attacking Piccolo and Gohan. Honestly, we'll just start right there. The one thing that I absolutely adore about this movie is that Goku and Vegeta, for once, are not the main focus. I mean, for the first time, at least since...
For a while, it just seemed like every movie and special and such, it was like, oh no, new supervillain. Oh, well, we'll just throw Goku and Vegeta at them and...
The worst example of this is, I don't know if you remember the movie Wrath of the Dragon, where for like 3/4 of the movie, Goku was off doing his own thing. And then pretty much the big climax, Goku just comes in, oh, hi, I'm the main character, Dragon Fist. And that's how it all ends.
Like, there are a few times in the movies and specials where they actually like stayed canonical in the continuity of Dragon Ball, which we're not going to really dive into all of the canonical stuff because of how flimsy the continuity of it all is. But there were a few movies where Goku was not the main character for a good chunk. Like, basically, any of the films or specials that aired after the Cell saga, Goku was nowhere to be found. It was mostly Gohan having to pick up the slack, or Goten and Trunks. Yes, it is extremely refreshing to go back to a Dragon Ball movie where Gohan and Piccolo are actually the main focus, because as much as they are extremely important to the franchise itself kind of pushed them to the side once more threatening and imposing characters came into play. It was kind of a bummer. Like, wow, Gohan beat Cell. Let's dial that back and bring back Goku.
And here's the thing. Gohan's been the subject of many debates, but one thing I kind of want to shut down immediately is the problem with Gohan. It's not that he's like not a fully committed warrior the way his father is. The problem is honestly in the execution. Most of the time, the character fumbles because the writer has no idea how they want to handle this character. And this movie pretty much answers a lot of those critiques.
Before we get more into the story, let's talk about the more quote-unquote controversial aspect of this film. It's all CGI. For the first time in the franchise's history, we have a full-fledged, full-blown CGI Dragon Ball film. Not moments where there are CGI. All the characters, except for like maybe a split second of footage, are all CGI. It's basically what if Studio Orange, the famous CGI animation studio that made Beastars, got a hold of Dragon Ball.
You and I have seen some not great CGI in the past,
right,
when it comes to anime, so I can say right away that this is very not at that level.
It's really good, actually, for theatrical quality CGI from Japan. It's up there. And they only did CGI because the director, Tetsuro Kodama, had more experience with CGI, which, hey, I'm not going to blame the guy for sticking to his guns and doing what he's the most comfortable with.
Right.
It was still going to take 3.5 years for this movie to come out anyway, y'all. Whether it was 2D or CGI. They do use lower frame rate to make the characters move like they were 2D anime characters. We're at this point where we've seen that done before, like I said, with Studio Orange and Polygon Pictures. It's not all that like shocking to look at, because Lordy, we do not need another X-Arm situation.
No.
Like, the animation is still very good. It doesn't matter if your film's 2D or CGI. It's all about how you execute it. They went the extra mile to basically cel shade everything or put 2D elements all over the CGI models and backgrounds. It still feels like a normal Dragon Ball film. Now, granted, it is definitely like it looks like a Dragon Ball film from the more super era with all the digital coloring and such.
Everyone, for the most part, is on model. The only two characters who are a little bit off are Goku and Vegeta, but
even then, they're fine.
If you aren't really sure what to look for, you're probably not going to notice like too many real differences in the character models. They're pretty consistent.
This is what it was going to look like if they changed it to CGI. They weren't going to go down the route of like the loop in the third to first film or anything like that. Because Dragon Ball has an absurdly iconic visual look. A lot of that because it's Akira Toriyama. You're not going to change Akira Toriyama's artwork. And the only time you can really notice of the low poly like CGI and such are in like the big vast background and some shots. But otherwise it's pretty good. Like it's pretty much polished Studio Orange level CGI, and the action doesn't falter under it or anything like that. Due to smart directing and cinematography, the action is still intense, it's impactful. You feel every punch, jab, kick, energy blast that hits is deflected or is sent flying into another direction.
And seeing this in Dolby was even extra special because you really get to feel the scope of like all of the battles, especially I think my favorite one in the rain at the Ribbon Army headquarters. That's when Gohan really gets into gear.
It looks great. You shouldn't have to worry too much about whether this is a downgrade from the last film. Even the last film had moments where the 2D animation looked a little clunky. The characters are all still very expressive, and they do all these fun little details with the characters, especially with how like Pan runs and bolts around. She's a lot of fun to watch, especially near the end when she's basically knocking down Red Ribbon soldiers left and right.
I think Pan might low-key be one of my favorite characters in this, and we'll get to why in a little bit, but going back to what you're saying about character details, they make even the most like mundane actions impressive.
One of my favorites, and I made sure to put this down in my own little review that I'm writing out, is how Piccolo holds his phone. It's like he's ready to like toss it if it sounds like it's about to explode on him. Like he holds it on like with his two fingers, it's just away from his body. And like when he's flying a jet later on in the film, he's only holding on to the joysticks, like, at the very tops. Like, he was handling, like, a bomb diffusion situation. It's very humorous how they do that. Or, like, how when you meet Dr. Hedo, and he's talking with Magenta.
Yeah.
And how they eat cookies. Like, even down to that little detail, like how Magenta grabs three of the cookies while Hedo just grabs one. There are smart character details here. And that matters, and they're probably given like more life than most of these Dragon Ball films ever gave them.
Yeah, even like the architecture and vehicles are full of life too. Like one of my favorite things is how the car that they pick up Hedo in has a dome for Carmine's pompadour.
Oh gosh, that's a fun little detail about that character. He cares so much about that pompadour that he puts a dome so his hair doesn't brush up against the ceiling of the car.
Also, Carmine has branding for everything, including his own YouTube channel.
They don't have many views, but he's going to be Carmine Productions everywhere. Edited, recorded, narrated by Carmine. He's an all-in-one YouTube production team. Now, they add so many cute little character details, and the dialogue is very funny. I mean, it's creative. On one hand, you get a lot of the typical like dialogue comedy and gag comedy moments with Dragon Ball because it's Akira Toriyama. Toriyama worked on gag comics before making Dragon Ball.
He naturally has like a very jovial sense of humor.
It's just like there's all these great little moments like when Piccolo is like realizes what's going on with the Red Ribbon Army coming back and such. He's calling Bulma, still holding his phone in like the most awkward way possible. And then a soldier kind of looks over and waves at him and he's like, oh, hey. And then comes back to talking to Bulma. Little puns, physical comedy, some raunchy comedy here and there. Not my favorite kind of comedy, but it's still very funny with how it works alongside everything else. Something else that's very distinct about the script, they make sure to fill up any gap that you would have questioning about what's going on with this whole movie.
I think you put it best off air when you described it as very CinemaSins proof.
They answer every single question. When they're going to get the Dragon Balls to make Piccolo stronger, why don't they just get rid of the Red Ribbon Army? Oh no, Piccolo's pride would get in the way. Okay, so with these new androids and this other thing that we'll talk about later, why don't they just get Vegeta and Goku here? They're on the God of Destruction's planet, fighting with Broly, and Bulma just can't get a hold of them, which is hilarious how that happens and such.
There's also the fact that, like, oh, Gohan hasn't been training in forever. That's why when he's wearing shoulder pads, he can't handle the weight. And really just all the conversations that Gohan and Piccolo have are just kind of perfect because, like I said earlier, they address all of the problems that his character has had since the end of the Cell games.
Well, yeah, and it's like sometimes the script sounds like it's trying to get ahead of like all the BuzzFeed articles or YouTubers who are like, top 10 plot holes in Dragon Ball Super Superhero. But a lot of the excuses makes sense. Vegeta would be stubborn enough to want to get into a fight with Goku just to see who's strongest and avoid and ignore everything. Well, what about Majin Buu? Why isn't he there?
Oh, he's just fast asleep because food's not involved.
Then with how they handle Pan, who could have been like the most obnoxious aspect of this film, she is not a damsel in distress. They made sure to write the story to give Pan the same kind of agency as the other main characters.
They'd even taken a step further where, A, she figures out right away that Piccolo is in disguise, so he can sneak into the Red Ribbon Army. It was his idea to kidnap Pan to motivate Gohan to go and rescue his daughter and stop the Red Ribbon Army. And what I love about that is just how perfect of an actor Pan is in the situation.
Right, she's delightful. She knows exactly what to do. Piccolo's all like, okay, you gotta fake feeling like you're being captured. And then when your dad gets here, you can just go all hog wild with kicking butt and such. She's like, okay. It's nice because any other franchise or writer would have made her a damsel in distress. Just the annoying kid that's only really there to get the plot going from the villains. And they just have a lot of fun little story beats also. I love when we get to first meet Dr. Hedo, how when he's leaving prison, you hear all the prisoners has given him flack and such. And he just reaches into a suitcase and throws a grenade back into the prison. Really gnarly grenade to cause that big of an explosion.
Seriously. They call back to that later where Krillin's like, I don't think they're going to want you back in the prison.
Then there's little story beats with like how they introduce Gamma 1 and 2, where Gamma 2 is like, oh yeah, I killed Piccolo. And then Gamma 1 is just like, so you didn't check the body? And it's like, oh yeah, no, it was just a big old puff cloud, like dust cloud. There was no way I found it. Let's talk about Gamma 1 and 2. For the most part, they are the pseudo-antagonists of the film. And it's definitely an interesting approach to bring back androids as a big threat to the Dragon Ball crew. Because it just seems always kind of interesting, like, wow, you can make these super powerful androids, and then they just kind of drop that, like, story aspect. Or just, like, they don't use the technology beyond, like, the Cell Saga and what have you.
I really like the choice to bring back the androids, but put a new twist on them. Like, this time, instead of creating androids to take over the world, Hedo created Gamma 1 and Gamma 2 to be kind of like this universe's version of like tokusatsu heroes. And the English voice actors, Alex Lee and Zeno Robinson, are perfect for these two characters and specifically the arcs that they have throughout the film.
Right. Gamma 1 is more the self-serious character, one who's like got to stick to the mission, while Gamma 2 is the more flashy, personality-driven of the two androids. And I like their designs. They still feel like Akira Toriyama designs. They're going to fit within the universe. Even if you shove them into Toriyama's other work, like Dragon Quest.
Or Dr. Slump.
They'd make sense. Nobody feels out of place. And the whole focus on superheroes is very interesting. Because, yeah, I think that's kind of what killed Dragon Ball for a little bit. It was the fact that superheroes started to get big right when Dragon Ball was starting to kind of leave the public conscious.
It's kind of like, I would say around 2004 when Spider-Man 2 opened in theaters, like it kind of seemed like Dragon Ball and the superhero boom kind of like met each other across in the street. But now Dragon Ball is pretty much back in the forefront, which is very nice.
Right, right. And a lot of this story like we said, it's all about Piccolo and his dynamic and relationship with Gohan. Pretty much feeling like Gohan is acting like a lot like Goku with his hyperfixation and feeling very neglectful about not being able to pick up Pan. Which it was very interesting to kind of see the whole trope of, you know, what everyone online likes to say, that Goku is one of the worst dads in anime. when it's mostly because Goku is just very free-spirited, kind of dumb, and has a hyper-fixation issue of when he just wants to train. And Gohan wants to work on his, like, college paper. And doesn't really think about the fact that, like, hey, you're not really being a part of your daughter's life. And it was interesting to see Piccolo be the most level-headed of the bunch again. Which, he was always one of the more level-headed individuals of the Dragon Ball cast.
Yep, even going as far back as the Saiyan Saga, when by no means did Piccolo have to do this, but he felt that, like, the Earth needed a protector, so he took Gohan under his wing, trained him, and then just kind of stuck around for the remainder of his life.
It's very touching. It's a very straightforward arc of the story of just, like, Gohan finally snapping into gear of, like, I have to be strong to protect the people I love, or else they could get killed. Even though death means nothing in Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
Yes, you can still feel the stakes of whatever villain shows up, and that the crew will probably not be strong enough to face them head on until Goku or Vegeta or whoever gets a new power level upgrade. But it's always going to be kind of funny how this world kills its own stakes. But that's a thing about Dragon Ball. There are just a lot of fantastical elements to the world that it crafts. But it's also, like, weird, a little unusual, and some parts don't make sense.
Like, the fact that this is a very technologically advanced civilization, yet dinosaurs still roam around the same way you see deer in your neighborhood.
One of the other things that they sort of bailed on were having, like, animal, like, humanoid, like, anthro characters. It was a really big part of, like, early Dragon Ball to have, like, a walking, talking cat, Korin, and such. And then as time went on, they became less and less, like, humanoid animals on, like, within living on Earth and such.
I remember, I guess he was called, like, the King of the Earth, was, like, humanoid cat creature. He was a big presence in the original Dragon Ball, but then you just kind of, like, don't see him again till maybe the Cell games. They've kind of,
like, retconned their own world building and such at points. It's pretty much you're either human
or you're an alien.
Yeah, or an alien or an otherworldly entity like Beerus or Wiz. I do love, like, the slight at its own, like, world of how Shenron is like, hello there, I'm here to give you your oh, hey, Piccolo. Because it's no one else. Nobody else searches for these Dragon Balls.
It's always the Z Fighters, or I guess more recently, Bulma and her Capsule Corpse team.
Yeah, I do love that whole sequence where Piccolo's is like, can you unlock my inner strength? And he's like, sure. And then they have three wishes. And then Bulma uses it for cosmetic reasons. And then they realize, oh man, we could have just called Goku and Vegeta back here. And then Piccolo's just like, well, why didn't you do that instead? And she's like, hey, you didn't think of it either. And then he's like, I guess I'll go get back into the Red Ribbon Army space. Just kind of shies away, like, oh, yeah, who am I to shame someone? The overall story is fun. It's straightforward, but they do add in, like, little story beats, like, more complex themes, especially with how Magenta essentially uses misinformation and, like, actual fake news and fake facts to persuade Dr. Hedo to make the androids and paint Capsule Corp and just the Z Fighters to being the bad guys.
He is definitely taking advantage of the fact that Hedo has kind of been out of the loop for a good enough while. Plus, with the whole generation gap, he's basically teaching, like, a revisionist history of the events of Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z, all for his gain.
And Dr. Hedo being, like, really fascinated with superheroes, which is also fitting with the MCU being one of the biggest things on Earth, gave Gamma 1 and 2 very strict, like they're lawful good.
Yeah, they were created to follow orders. While they certainly can have their doubts, it's pretty clear that they're not really big fans of kidnapping innocent people. They also kind of have to abide by that too.
Right, and even like when Carmine tries to shoot Pan, Gamma 1's like, no, that's despicable. You can't do that. It's very interesting because, you know, we're dealing with a lot of that right now. And it always seems like misinformation was always a reoccurring theme in a lot of films. Even like the last one, where basically they had this giant murder monster. They're like, no, you are fighting the wrong side, man. Now, the voice cast is also very good. It's a lot of the same Funimation, Dragon Ball era crew of like Kyle Hebert, Christopher Spott, John Schimmel, Jeannie Tirado, Alex Slay, Zeno Robinson, Zach Aguilar. It was very surprising to hear Charles Martinet, aka the voice of Mario, as Magenta, which is amusing because it's basically like the tone that he uses for the character is if Wario was articulate.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty accurate way to put it.
Yeah. And then like they had Jason Marnoka, Sony Strait, Monica Rial, Justin Cook, Johnny Yong Bosch is the voice of Broly. Because, you know, for some reason, the last movie just didn't have a voice actor for Broly. It was weird.
I know, so strange.
And then they had Meredith McCoy, Jason Douglas, Ian Sinclair, Robert McCollum, Eric Vale, Kara Edwards, Erica Lynn Beck, Bruce Carey, and then Damon Clark. They all do a very good job. They have like moments to shine and such. Kind of a bummer Krillin turned out to be a cop.
Yeah, I'm not sure why in Dragon Ball Super that was the direction of his character, but whatever. It's Krillin.
Well, we talk about how Gohan and Piccolo were like pushed to the side. Krillin and like Yamcha were just like pushed way further to the side. Like, I get it. They wanted Krillin like after he fell in love with Android 18. He just wanted to have a normal life. I get that.
To be fair, in Super, he does get some really cool moments. But again, just going back to the fact that his day job now is a police officer is interesting.
Well, it's like he's one of the strongest people on Earth, and yet he has such a pedestrian job. But, you know, it's whatever. It's his life. He does what he wants. Let's talk about the third act. Throughout the whole movie, they keep alluding to a bigger threat than Gamma 1 and Gamma 2. That Magenta wants to unleash onto the world with Cell Max, which is basically a super upgraded version of Cell. Though what's kind of perfect about this is that Dr. Hedo was really not on board with this, like part of the plan of making this like super amped up version of Cell, because it's not made with science like his androids were. He had more passion and drive to make more androids, and what he sees with Cell Max is just a monster. And they keep alluding to the fact that Cell Max is not ready yet. He's not ready. If you unleash him now, he could destroy you and the rest of the world. And it's also fitting for the fact that Cell Max's form is imperfect Cell. Like, I haven't seen Dragon Ball in forever, like the original show or Super, but I can tell you so many details. Like, there's this little vault in the back of my head holding all like the Dragon Ball knowledge.
Yeah. The choice to make him imperfect Cell is, well, for lack of a better term, perfect.
Right. First of all, it fits the whole like superhero third act thing of fight giant monster, because this is before Perfect Cell has like the more human motif instead of the monstrous alien-like look with the tail and such. But I will say it is a bit of a bummer that the androids, like, they were always probably going to turn out to be the good guys by the end. But it's a shame that the androids get pushed aside to a sort of retread of the Cell saga.
I mean, you're not wrong.
I mean, I don't get me wrong. I still had a blast with this third act. It's great. The action is fantastic.
Gamma 2 gets probably one of the best moments out of any like character in recent memory.
Right, right. and Cell Max is just a threat to behold, and like everyone that they have, which is funny. They're like, hey, I brought the world's strongest heroes and Krillin. Poor Krillin. So one of the other things that I've seen kind of brought up in discussion, Gohan's new form, which I think has been nicknamed Beast Gohan.
They're calling it Gohan Beast, which really is sort of a redraw of Super Saiyan 2, but as an adult and with larger silver hair.
Which is funny to me because I remember when Kids Next Door made fun of that whole aspect where the hair was just so big that the character couldn't move. It's just funny. It's like out of all the changes that could have happened, they could have gone with Super Saiyan 4 from the GT era or timeline of the show. But they didn't. They went with bigger hair that's silver. Now, do you think Gohan earned this new transformation?
I could look at this two ways. On the one hand, my gut tells me yes, because this is just another example of that sort of inner rage that Gohan has always had throughout the series, starting from the time that he busted out of Raditz's pod, like at the start of the Saiyan saga. Also, when Lord Guru unleashed his ultimate potential, that was another example of him kind of rising to the occasion. And then, of course,
Garlic Jr.
Yeah, the Garlic Jr. saga. And then, of course, the ultimate moment for him was at the end of the Cell saga, when he finally unleashed Super Saiyan 2. And then in the Majin Buu saga, he again unlocked his full potential and became what we refer to as Ultimate Gohan. So
before he gets eaten by Majin Buu at one point.
Yeah. And then before he starts to go backwards again. As far as did he earn this new boost, I would ultimately say yes. Because I say yes, because he is unleashing all of his potential for the right reason, protecting the Earth and the people that he cares about.
Okay, so what's the other thing that he, because you said you're looking at it two ways. What's the second way?
On the other hand, as far as like exactly what this form is, they will have to explain that in future stories, because it's not God energy the way Goku and Vegeta have achieved Super Saiyan Blue. And it's not quite Super Saiyan Rage like what Trunks had in the Goku Black arc. So I don't know specifically what power he has, but the question of whether or not he earned it, that's a yes.
No, it just seems like it's going to be interesting because I don't know if they're making another series or not. I kind of forgot if they were or not.
It hasn't been confirmed, but something is in the works. There are like rumors about more Dragon Ball content pretty much every day.
Right. Well, they kind of have to, because this is the second film in a row that keeps referencing that one Dragon Ball super villain that Goku had the fight. Jiren. It's just kind of funny in that regards, because it's like they keep building him up and it's like, okay, are you going to do something about it? So, I mean, it doesn't really matter to me. It's just interesting how long they are keeping that up. Yes, I can understand it being kind of a disappointment that Goku and Vegeta get sidelined, but the post-credit scene pretty much makes up for it.
It does.
With Vegeta finally beating Goku one-on-one fight with no super enhancements or energy blasts or world-ending stuff. And nobody is there to really see it.
They've all either like passed out or just distracted, except for Broly and Lemo, who are just like in tears when this is all over.
Oh, it's hilarious. I love it. Because I was thinking, like, what's this post-credit scene going to be? Is it like Cell Max is going to be perfect Cell Max or something like that? No, it's just a very goofy scene where Vegeta's like, finally, I win. And nobody's there to see it. So it's going to be a real case of his word against everyone else's. And we all know how Vegeta is when he wants to top Goku as the strongest and such.
Yeah, that's a rivalry that will never die, no matter how old these two get.
Right. And I get it, like, with how the script writes out some parts, it could be a little on the nose. But I think it's written in a way that's not so like, okay, we get it. You write your way around the fact that a lot of this could have been easily solved. But I think it works. I don't have too many complaints outside of maybe the new form could have been better handled, or how Cellmax is just not as interesting as a threat, or the villains of the Red Ribbon Army, or the ones that we have with Magenta and or Carmine. I just remembered how goofy a lot of these names are, just how so many other characters are named. Their names are references to other kinds of gags, like how the Saiyans are named after vegetables, and just names like Garlic Jr. or Frieza, King Cold, Cooler.
Oh, it gets even sillier. The last arc in the Dragon Ball Super manga has characters named like Granola, Muesli, and like the planet they're fighting on is like cereal or something.
Oh gosh darn it.
It doesn't get less silly as the franchise continues.
Well, it's just funny because like this franchise can get very dark, but yet it has a tongue firmly planted in cheek vibe to it all. And that's what makes these movies fun. Even the weaker ones, to a degree, are a delight to sit through because there's this vibe and energy that you can't get with any other series out there. And this movie's a lot of fun. I think in terms of films based off of TV shows, it's not my favorite. I still think the Bob's Burgers movie is overall the best. But once again, we're in a year where we've had like now four great movies based off of TV shows.
I'm surprised that we have like that many in a row that have been like, you know, legitimately great films.
Well, five actually, because, you know, Jujutsu Kaisen Zero came out this year. So
that's right. And that was, I think, the first out the gate.
Yeah, I think it was. So overall, like, I got what I wanted with a Dragon Ball film. It's clever enough. It's funny. It's endearing. The action's great. If I wanted a deeper, more methodical or philosophical quandary of a film, I would have turned on like the original Ghost in the Shell film from Mamoru Oshii, or just turn on any other stuff that he's worked on. With Dragon Ball, you'd want a more lighthearted adventure with tons of action. The Gamma 1 and 2 robots are these very likable and endearing brother-like characters that bring a new flair to the cast of characters. And if you're a fan of Dragon Ball, the Easter eggs and references and nods and like everything of the franchise is in this movie.
Oh, yeah. So Dragon Ball turns 40 in like 2 years. What I love about this movie is this really does bridge like the gaps between multiple generations. And the fact that they use the Red Ribbon Army as the antagonists, it's perfect because they've been an antagonistic presence in everything from Dragon Ball to Dragon Ball Z to even to a lesser extent, GT. And now we're in Super, and it's all come full circle.
If you can catch it in theaters, if it's still playing by this time, definitely give it a watch. As much as I like want everyone to go see every anime film out there that gets a US theatrical release, that's not always going to be the case. Some have bigger releases, and I know this one was always going to be one of the bigger like films to get a wider release than normal. Plus, there's just not much else out there right now.
August is a pretty dry movie month, which also should be expected because, you know, the pandemic kind of shut down production on a lot of films. So between that and August, pre-pandemic was already like a barren wasteland anyway. Now would be like the perfect time to release a movie like Dragon Ball, which will attract an audience like no matter what.
Right, right. I was a little worried at first about how open this would be for newcomers to the franchise, and it's pretty open. It definitely like gives you a quick crash course of the franchise, though I would say it's a little tougher to get into because it's not you know, Goku and Vegeta saving the day. It's Piccolo and Gohan. And a lot of the emotional stakes of this are connected to you knowing about their long history together.
I think, though, just as a standalone film, they give you just enough information so that you can go in, like, understanding enough of each character's motivation. But I would agree, and speaking as a fan, if you are a lifelong Dragon Ball fan, you will probably have a deeper appreciation than if you are going into this for the first time. But I would also recommend anyone see this movie, whether you are a longtime fan or a newbie, because if you like this, it will inspire you to go back to the beginning and check everything else out.
Right. Yeah, no. Give it a watch. And well, that's it for this mini episode. We're going to get back to the summer anime season recap next time.
But until then, Cameron, where can everyone find you online?
You can find me on Twitter at CamsEyeView. I have my own website called CamsEyeView.biz. I have a Patreon at patreon.com/CamsEyeView. That's where you can find me.
And you guys can find me on Twitter at CaptainK42. You can check out my quick thoughts on letterboxd.com/CoachK42. And you can follow Renegade Pop Culture on Facebook and Twitter at Ren Pop Culture. We're also on YouTube. You can find us on Podchaser and the Banana Meter. Listen to all of our podcasts on Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, etc. And last but not least, everything can be found at RenegadePopCulture.com. Need an escape? So do we. That'll do it for this episode of Renegade Animation. We will catch you guys later. Peace out.